I remember during my time in Afghanistan on my second combat deployment, which was right about the transition time for Karzai. And on the ground, everybody knew that he was just completely corrupt. And I mean, to the point of bags of cash, pallets of cash, everybody knew it on the ground there. And of course, every time the camera started rolling, anybody asked a question, especially in the United States, it's like, no, there's no corruption here at all. We have people on the ground to make sure all this kind of stuff, but we knew it didn't. And Karzai was getting money out, you know, hand over fist. Then at the end, when the very end came, the then president of Afghanistan again was moving large sums of money. And we were still shoveling a lot of it in there. Do you see any potential corollaries between those two? And might that tell you anything about where we are in this war?
Well, I think there is similar. It's a interesting story you brought up there. I think the main difference between the situation in Afghanistan, what you have in Europe, is so many governments and the European Union, the super state, the supranational body of the European Commission, are also playing a direct role in keeping this thing going. So it's like it's almost like the corruption scandal. This one is, to me, indicative of the potential breakdown of at least the U.S., the complete, you know, unconditional backing of the Zelensky regime, because the scandal's coming out of NABU. And NABU, the anti-corruption agency, was set up by Victoria Nuland and the U.S. Embassy.
Oh, I missed that origin part.
Yeah, in 2014. So this came in during that sort of Maidan, the whole Maidan thing, and then was kind of formalized when Petro Poroshenko was installed as president in the spring of 2014. And the reason they set up NABU, this is what you have to understand. There's SAPO and NABU. SAPO is the Ukrainian agency. It's mostly more or less Ukrainian run. NABU was overseen by the United States, and they even had their sort of loyalists that were installed in the key positions. I know this because we did at 21st Century Wire a lot of deep reporting on the Hunter Biden and Burisma and Biden corruption in Ukraine. We have a great archive on this. And so what the whole point of NABU, this is my opinion, obviously I'm not alone in this, that the U.S. set it up not to stop corruption in Ukraine, but to surveil corruption, to protect the corrupt elements that they wanted to keep quiet and keep undercover, and to bust anybody. It's like having bouncers at a nightclub, and the bouncers control the drug dealing inside, and they only bust the drug dealers that aren't paying their 10% or their 50, whatever, their cut. So this is what NABU was. And I think personally, it was also done to protect a lot of the Biden corruption and to prevent a prosecutor general like Viktor Shokin or independent investigators like Alexander Dubinsky, who's in jail, like Konstantin Kulik, who was threatened with jail by Zelensky and left the country, like Andrei Derkash, who was investigating and had to flee the country. So anybody that was actually trying to do anti-corruption work was being threatened by the U.S.-backed Ukrainian puppets. And so NABU was just there to kind of manage that whole thing so the U.S. had a heads up in advance. We're ahead of the curve on all of these various things that were breaking. But the fact that this scandal comes out of NABU and Zelensky's main bagman, who was his partner in the media conglomerate, his name was Mindich, and this was bankrolled by Igor Kolomoisky, who's a Ukrainian oligarch, who Zelensky arrested, I think probably also to somewhat protect him, to keep him in jail, because it's a semi-safe place to be in this environment. But the fact that it came out of NABU means that the U.S. is not providing that super layer of protection for Zelensky, and it's hit his inner circle. So this is invariably going to hit public confidence in Ukraine, but also in Europe, although the Europeans won't come out and say they're worried about this, and the leadership level, the Donald Tusk level, the von der Leyen level, the Merz level, the Macron level, they're not going to say there's any problem with this corruption thing. You saw Macron. He's wrote in there immediately as a response to the corruption scandal, did this whole public relations show with Zelensky signing on for weapons that haven't been manufactured yet for money that nobody has. 100 Rafale jets.
Look at those smiles there, man. He's like, this is working great.
So what they're signing here is not an arms deal. What they're signing is a memorandum of understanding. It is a non-binding memorandum of understanding. There's not an arms deal. They don't have the pilots for these Rafale jets. Aren't available, haven't been built yet, or they're old block models that haven't been retrofitted yet. Yeah. So we're talking 10 years. Zelensky's going to be long gone. He's either going to be on a ski slope in Geneva or the beach in Miami living next to Yair Netanyahu or somewhere else. But he's not going to be there. So whatever they're signing is null and void, probably by...
Okay. So help me understand this then. And I'm afraid of your answer as I'm even forming the question in my mind. Is it just as blatant as they're setting this up? So if Macron was there to try to forestall some of the negative impact and the loss of confidence, et cetera, and all of this corruption that came into light, they know they can't win. I can only imagine that they know that they cannot militarily win. And yet, are they just saying, okay, let's just keep this limping train going a little bit longer, as long as we can, before that they literally just die on the vine? So I'm going to let that go in here, as opposed to saying, all right, well, this is not helping. This is not working anything. Let's bring this to an end. I mean, why would they do that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One of them is there's a big shiny object on the shelf that everybody wants to get their hands on, and that's called Russian assets, okay? $320 billion worth of frozen Russian assets, $180 billion of which is located in Belgium in the Euroclear, which is the clearinghouse and with the SWIFT system and the international clearance system. And they've seized there and other central banks, they've seized these Russian assets. So all the money where this is going to come from is going to be from that. And the Europeans are banking on grabbing that money to pay for all this, and they think with the Russian money, they'll be able to kind of keep this party going for at least two or three more years, maybe 5 years.
So why haven't they gotten it so far? Because they've obviously been talking about this from the beginning of the war, and yet nearly 4 years in, they still haven't. What's the hesitancy?
Well, first of all, Euroclear is based in Belgium, and Belgium has rejected categorically this move by Brussels or this initiative to steal the Russian assets, because it would set an awful precedent legally. And it means that not only that, because the U.S. is sanctioning lots of different countries now, they're threatening sanctions, they're doing tariffs, punitive tariffs. So it could even be an allied country of the U.S. that could get threatened with secondary sanctions in the future. So this is a test case that could destroy this entire SWIFT system or confidence in it for half of the world. And we're talking, the BRICS bloc represents 20% of global GDP, and increasing by the year, probably with the productivity gains of China, Brazil, India, for example. And people are at the same time fleeing the dollar. So while this would give a short-term opium hit to Europe for its finances, in the long term, it would really destroy this system of globalization that the West has painstakingly constructed.
Okay, but I mean, I can get the whole shiny object thing and want that, but I mean, we got to be honest. In the larger terms of economies, 300 and whatever billion, it ain't that much money. I mean, is it really worth risking all of that future for a handful of dollars today?
It is a lot for Europe. This is a lot of money. Maybe not as much from a U.S. perspective, but for Europe, it is a lot of money. You're talking about Europe that has a GDP projected growth for 2026, a very optimistic projection of 1.1% GDP growth. 1.1%. So this is the advanced economy of the world in 1.1%. So how they're planning to pay for it now, before they steal these Russian assets, are basically that they're calling it the safe instrument. This is what Ursula von der Leyen and the others are punting out. And the safe instrument is to basically create euro bonds or war bonds for Europe. But then those are interest-bearing bonds. And then they're going also to charge interest and give that money to the individual member states as a loan. So there's two layers of interest on it. And so they're going to create bonds to loan member states so they can buy weapons for Ukraine. So they're calling it joint procurement. Okay. So there's no money here, Danny. There's war bonds.
Where are they going to pay the interest on these bonds when they come to the like,
I'll tell you what the collateral is, Danny. It's that Russia is going to pay reparations when Ukraine wins. That is it.
And they're literally banking on that?
It is. That is the bottom line on the contract.
Oh my God.
That's the bottom line of the contract. That Russia, these are guaranteed by Russian reparations. This is a big gamble, isn't it? If you think about it. So that's why they're so desperate to steal this money, because that would plug the hole. Because right now the war bond thing, it's very tenuous. It's very tenuous because it's banking on Russia losing, but and paying reparations. Russia's winning. They're definitely not going to be paying reparations.
Okay, let's take a look at the foundation upon that gamble that they're looking at. This is a post from X here just a couple of days ago on the 15th by Julian Ripka, who's is very pro-Ukraine, a German, works for Bild, has been fairly accurate in what he's discussed over the years, what he's put out. But he even is finally, this is a long post here, but this is the top of it, the most important part. He's kind of disgusted by the situation here because he writes, however, the situation can no longer be glossed over by PR actions from the Ukrainian general staff, nor by the sugarcoating or ignoring of the part of the government in Kiev. Ukraine is heading towards a strategic defeat against Russia's invasion forces. And then he goes on to the whole thing to explain why that is. And he might as well have been watching our show because, when you and I have talked about all the issues that are on that post, and it's just self-evident that that's the true statement. Given that that's the case, he's just calling out loud what exists, despite what all these claims are, like Manuel Macron, like Friedrich Merz, like Keir Starmer, who just want to pretend like none of that stuff's going on. But they have to know, right? I mean, right? They do know that what Julian Ripka is saying, what we're talking about, is what's real, right?
For this guy to say that, this was the head of the cheerleading squad from day one of this war. So for him to say this, that is a major canary in the coal mine for Europe. And, look, Danny, it's not politically acceptable for any European leader to wave the white flag at this point. And it's almost like they're engaged in a level of Soviet-esque propaganda. Everybody doesn't believe it, but they still have to say that publicly. Otherwise, the party, whatever that party is in Europe now, the war party, if you will, the globalist BlackRock war party, loses face. And you have total collapse in confidence in the system, and defeat is imminent at that point. That's why they have to, the leaders, these hugely unpopular European leaders, have to put this brave front up and just keep it all smiles, all positive. Yeah, we've got money here, we've got money there, we got this deal, this new instrument, this new scheme, the latest one, the safe instrument. A month ago, there was something else. Then the month previous, there was another thing. Do you remember when they had the war? We're going to raise hundreds of billions, $750 billion to rebuild the
Europe. $800 billion is what the number was.
$800 billion. You remember?
Yeah.
What happened to
rebuild
that?
Rebuild Europe.
That's gone. And then it's been replaced three times over by this point. And that, now they're even talking about stealing Russian assets, holding them in escrow, and then gambling them on the world casino, and then using the interest from their winnings to fund Ukraine. I mean, talk about desperate.
But see, here's the we're just going to go down one more level into the rabbit hole of the just disinformation or just incombobulation. I don't even know if there's a right word for this. It's just weird for the European leaders to be going down this path, gambling like you're talking about right there. And I see the path that it is, all the stuff that Rupke could talk about. And of course, he's talking about the front line, the air war that's going in Russia's favor, the manpower issue, et cetera. And then you actually added something here on your X post about 10 hours ago, where you're talking about not just the lack of troops coming in, not just the casualties going out, but the fact that there's all these desertions. I mean, this huge number, according to what's this information you got here on your that you posted on your screen here, 161,000 through 2025 alone. And we're still not even finished with 2025 as compared to the previous 3 years. Well, I mean, what does that tell you?
Yeah, and this is discounting, you know, the many tens of thousands that have fled to Germany and other European countries that are you know, completely out of the system at this point. But it is, if you look at those, let's just say those are official numbers, and you look at the trajectory of that graph, that hockey stick is definitely going in the wrong direction for Ukraine. So that means that it means that it's just proof that the level, the skill level of the actual soldier on the front line is getting progressively worse and worse. They're not fielding, what are they, in their fifth army at this point?
Something like that, yeah.
Of the conflict. So, and they still have to keep, you know, their special forces intact and other people to protect the capital and to protect the government. And also use them as local enforcers, as a Praetorian Guard, if you will, for the Zelensky regime in Kiev. So, and Russia's going all in on drones. That, you know, and when I say Russia is fully mobilized, I'm talking about economically fully mobilized. They've geared their military industrial complex in Russia towards this conflict, and they're all in on drones, and they're all in on advanced missile tech and electronic warfare and all of these things that are this decisive battlefield factors of this conflict.
Now, it's not just you and I that are saying this, and most of the Europeans, and you just mentioned several of them, the senior leaders, Ursula von der Leyen, Kaya Kallas, Macron, you know, just a minute ago, obviously Zelensky, but there are some on the other side, and of course, from the beginning, Viktor Orban has been very crystal clear about where he is on this. He just came to Washington where he almost directly to Trump in front of the cameras said that Ukraine can't win. When given an opportunity and pressed on it, he actually paused, hesitated, looked over at Trump and said, well, maybe a miracle, I guess, because he didn't want to say it in front of him at the time. But here a couple of days ago, he was not quite so reserved.
European politics intellectually is very sophisticated, but what they are saying basically means that they would not like to have a peace just now. They would like to continue the war. They think, and they speak about it publicly, that we have to continue the war to support Ukraine more. The situation will improve on the front line, and we will have a better circumstances or preconditions for negotiation. Wrong, totally wrong, not to speak about geopolitics and human dimension. Economically and financially is just crazy. We finance a country which has no chance to win the war, but at the same time, there's a high level of corruption.
No chance to win the war. He's just straight up saying that. Now, let me ask your opinion. Do you think that the Mance, the Macron, the Starmers, et al., Ursula von der Leyen's even, do you think that they know the same thing, Orban, or do you think that they have convinced themselves that it's not true?
I wish I can say that they know the facts, but they're just putting on a political face. But I do see there is a level of delusion of people that are not living in reality, not just in Europe, but also in Washington as well. High ranking people that are not dealing with reality, and maybe they're military commanders that are scared to death about telling the truth to the political leaders for fear of, you know, having their career cut short. Washington being the ultimate example of that at this present moment. Okay, the same goes for Europe. So I want to say, I mean, Orban's been consistent from the beginning, and you know, a year ago I was in Budapest and we were meeting and speaking with heads of military, heads of government departments, foreign ministry, and so forth. And it was a unanimous, it was very clear there was a consensus in Hungary a year ago that they're not interested in escalation. They want to be at the negotiation table yesterday, and that there's no appetite in Hungary for this, and it's not in Hungary's interest or in Slovakia's interest for that matter, or Romania's interest for that matter, truth be known. Yeah. Everybody who's on the front line of that conflict, other than Poland, is not as hawkish as the British, the Germans, and the Americans too.
And I would even argue that the Poles are not that hawkish. They like to talk on stuff, but they don't want to be taking any action. It's going to get bombs dropping on their front yard either.
No, there's problems with this conflict in Poland. I mean, to put these crazy statements by Donald Tusk and others, but even Tusk will flip-flop into reality now and again.
Flip-flop into reality, that's quite a statement.
but like, I'll give you a perfect example. This sabotage of this train line, which hit Poland just in the last 24 hours, that connected Lublin to Warsaw. And immediately, as soon as there was news of this, you could see all the Europeans, everybody's making these statements. This is an attack on NATO soil. Just like 2 days ago, there was a Ukrainian tanker on the river bordering Ukraine and Romania on the Ukrainian side that was hit supposedly by a Russian drone. And immediately, a British MP, Defense Committee, I believe, member Tom Tugendhat said, this is an attack on NATO territory, you know, and it wasn't. It was on the Ukrainian side. So Russia warned in September, their foreign ministry made a statement that they basically cracked they got an intelligence intercept about false flags, and that these would be coming in Poland and in Romania. And also we published the reports about Moldova, Transnistria, and that these false flags would be used to escalate the conflict and to reinvigorate the appetite on the European and Western side for conflict. So
this point here, all war, according to Sun Tzu, is based on deception. And I think that we're living proof of that here. To what extent do you think that maybe some of these, maybe Russia's saying it's going to be a false flag, but it's really their flag, and they're trying to false flag, mm-hmm, to make it look like, but they actually want to send a message. How much possibility you give that?
I wouldn't rule it out, to be honest. I mean, because they're using asymmetric warfare against Russia. So it would be, Russia would say, well, we too can play at that game. But on the Polish train sabotage, which happened today, there was all this saying, oh, is a Russian attack, is a Russian attack. And immediately then the reports came out 3 hours later that they have two Ukrainian suspects in custody. And then now the media is doing a workaround in Poland and Germany saying these are Ukrainians that are working for the Kremlin.
Definitely.
So I don't know the answer to your question, Danny. I really don't. But what I do know is that it's the fake drone crisis. You remember the fake drone crisis?
Yeah.
About 4 weeks ago. That was, to me, part of that, you know, that was a probing exercise. For the potential for drone false flags is endless, just because of the nature of the technology. So but it seemed to me like that was completely fake, because you have to rewind a little bit when this happens. You say, how is it in Russia's interest?
Yeah,
to be sending a few wasps, you know, to hit a giant hornet's
nest. Unarmed in most cases, by the way.
I mean, it's just, it doesn't make any sense. And like the train thing, it doesn't make any sense. Now, if it was a false flag that was botched on the NATO side, or they're trying to make it look like it was the Russians doing it, I still don't see the benefit on the Russian side. I would if they were losing or somehow, you know, but they're not. So I really don't know. They could say it's Putin sowing confusion. You know, they always say this in Europe. Putin's trying to confuse us with his disinformation. He's so clever, this Putin, that he's trying to just dazzle us with false flags and disinformation. I don't know. But what I do know is who's desperate. Europe is desperate. Zelensky is desperate. Those are the desperate parties. So to me, the balance of probability would be the West and Ukraine would be involved in some kind of provocations, staged provocations, that would somehow you know, revive interest in this conflict and motivate the West, or at least the political West, to continue doubling down on it.